Okay, let's start. So the next speaker is Ben Peter from Max Planck Institute. And he's going to talk about 100,000 years of gene flow between Neanderthals and Denisovans.
Yes. Well, first, thanks to Luis and Etienne and also Fernando for inviting me and having me. I had a lot of fun with all the previous speakers. And yeah, so I'm going to talk about Neanderthals and Denisovans. And a lot of the work and pretty much all the data I'm going to talk about has been generated by sort of the people that have been at my department for the last two decades, really, Xvante Pabo, Matthias Meyer, and Janet Kelso. And so I joined the department a bit over 4 years ago, and when I came there, essentially what they did, in some sense, can be, I think, nicely characterized by this cartoon here, where people, or what they do is, essentially, they have bones and Neanderthal fossils, and what they have sort of generated and established over the last year is this machine that results in a mess of DNA. And so what I'm interested in is sort of how we can actually learn from this mess of DNA and learn about human history and our relations with Neanderthals and Denisovans. And so to give a very brief overview about what we know about Neanderthals and Denisovans, or what we think sort of the working models are, is that we think that we diverged from each other roughly 500,000 to 600,000 years ago. And then Neanderthals and Denisovans, sort of this lineage over here. See if this works. Yeah, they're split shortly after that. And then as we go more into the current day, this is of the models that, for example, Simon and many other people talked about. And what you can sort of notice, sort of what I like about this figure is that, you know, if you look at this top half, it looks very simple. And then as we go closer to the present and where we have more data and which is more recent, we get more and more of these sort of arrows. And I think if sort of one theme emerged from this conference is that whenever we have a tree like this, we probably need to add many more arrows in pretty much all the places. And sort of spoiler alert, I'm going to do exactly the same, just up here. But maybe to start with, let's give a brief overview about what we actually know about the genetics of Neanderthals and Denisovans, because despite it receiving quite a bit of attention, that the record we have, or the, from genetic data from Neanderthals and Denisovans, is actually quite sparse, right? So as most of you will know, Neanderthals have been studied for, I think, over 200 years now, with the first fossils developed in the early 19th century. But for many of those, I think well over 100 sites now where Neanderthals have been known, but genetic data actually has been relatively hard to retrieve, and that's mainly due to Neanderthals being quite old, right? We sort of think they went extinct roughly 40,000 years ago. And so this is sort of an overview about all the sites for which we have nuclear genetic data from Neanderthals. And I highlighted three sites here, one in Croatia, Vindhya, and two in Siberia, Chukotka and Denisova. And these are the three sites for which we have actually high coverage genomes. So these are like 25 to, I think, 50x genomes, where we can sort of do good genotype calls. And the vast sort of amounts of insights that we have about Neanderthals come from these three sites, from specimens from these three sites where we have good quality data. But there's a lot of other sites, like one here in Zmajskaya and in Western Europe, for which we are able to retrieve Neanderthal DNA, but because the data is highly degraded, we have much less power to sort of talk about what's going on then. And then sort of the other, I think, major success story of ancient DNA, particularly for archaic genomes, is the discovery of Denisovans, right? So Denisovans were first described purely by genetics. Because the sort of fossil record of Denisovans is extremely sparse, right? So we have, so it can easily be sort of summarized in one slide here. We have these three teeth and this bone fragment from Denisova cave, which are numbered Denisova 2, 8, 3, and 4. And then more recently, based on sort of proteomics, this mandible from Tibet was described as a Denisovan. And then very recently, mostly based on morphology, this fossil from Kobra Cave in Laos has been suggested to be a Denisovan. But that's essentially it, what you have in terms of morphology, right? So everything about Denisovans that we know or sort of learned about is based on genomics. And more specifically, almost everything we know is based on this one fossil here, Denisova 3, for which we have a high coverage genomes, because for the three other Denisovans, again, the data that we retrieved was extremely sparse. And so in some sense, the talk about gene flow between Anderson and Denisovans is that it occurred has been well established, in particular by this one individual called Denisova 11, which has been shown to be a direct offspring of a Neanderthal and Denisovan. So it's a Neanderthal mother, a Denisovan father, and my colleague's control is a Denisovan, sort of for the first generation offspring. But nevertheless, sort of, I think there's a lot of questions about what, how common was that? Was this a one-off? Was this a more long-term thing? And this is sort of what I'm going to focus about. And sort of to talk about that is, I'm going to sort of introduce a concept that I think also many previous speakers already used. I'm going to talk about admixture tracks, so bits of a genome or bits of a chromosome in a population that have an origin in a different population. And to just sort of recap on how these arise is that let's suppose you have a Denisovan and a Neanderthal, and they each have a pair of chromosomes here, and they have an offspring. And so what happens in the first generation is that this individual will have one full Neanderthal genome from the Neanderthal dad, and one Denisovan chromosome from the other parent. But then what will happen if, say, this individual moves into a Neanderthal population and lives in a Neanderthal population is that it will, in some sense, backcross and sort of have this sort of, or what it will pass on to its to its offspring, will sort of this recombined chromosome where you have a bunch of crossing overs, right? So it will have some bits of Denisovan ancestry, some bits of Neanderthal ancestry, which will switch. And then over and over, or over many generations, if this individual keeps reproducing a Neanderthal population, then these fragments will become smaller and smaller over time. And this is one way we can sort of, for example, learn how or when gene flow happened by sort of looking how long are these fragments and then sort of calculating back this process to up here. And so this has been done quite extensively, primarily with sort of interactions between Neanderthals and Denisovans and modern humans, right? So I'm sure Ram, who talked earlier, did some very important pioneering work on that. Here I have sort of two key slides, one by Verno and Akey and one from the Brownings. So the Brownings sort of have the summary figure here on the left where they talk about Denisovan ancestry in modern humans, where they showed that, or it's one of the nice papers to show that the people from New Guinea have sort of a very large amount of Denisovan ancestry, and people from East Asia have two different types of Denisovan ancestry. So they could sort of distinguish two different types versus people in Europe essentially have no Denisovan ancestry. And there's been many recent papers from folks here that suggest that the models we have or that they have here is actually a lot more complex, and there might be, I think, five or more different events. And I think that's something that's still, this slide is already outdated, I think, in many ways, and will be more outdated in the very near future. In comparison, the Neanderthal ancestry is somewhat simpler in that most people outside Africa have sort of quite similar amounts of Neanderthal ancestry that's distributed all over the genome. People in Africa have also some Neanderthal ancestry, but that's mostly due to, we think, to later gene flow between Europeans and Africans. And so when I started this project, it was very simple. Like, so people have done this for, I'd say about a decade now, and so asked it, why can't we do this with ancient genomes, right? Does this not work? And as it turns out, and I think this is actually something to my surprise, nobody else introduced it, ancient DNA is actually quite tricky to work with in many ways, right? So for one thing, it's what we retrieve actually is not nice genomes, but it's highly fragmented, right? So a typical molecule we obtain has a length distribution like this, and this is in base pairs, right? So for many sort of Neanderthal genomes, sort of the mode of length is in order to 40 to 50 base pairs. So very, very short, and it's hard to assemble those into contiguous tracks that we would want to use for, say, these local ancestry inference, right? And then the other major issue is that ancient DNA is often heavily contaminated, right? So this is just a few examples. So the first Neanderthal genome, what actually was sequenced, you know, sort of the DNA, raw DNA data that came out was 96% actually microbes, and only about 4% of it was, like, came from the Neanderthal fossils that were studied in this time, and maybe 1% or so was from was contamination from modern humans. And there's been so the other high coverage genomes have been published, like the Vindhya and Altai genome, so they have higher proportion of endogenous DNA, but they are the exception, essentially the reason that they were sequenced high coverage. For the vast majority of Neanderthals that our study, it looks more like this, that we have on the order of 99% microbial DNA, roughly 1% of it is modern human DNA, and then a tiny, tiny amount of it that is actually from the Neanderthal that we would like to study. And so what I wanted to do, or sort of what the foundation of this work is that I wanted to do a local ancestry inference method that sort of deals with this issue, that we have low coverage, that we often have contamination by modern humans, that we have to take into account this damage. And then because we study Neanderthals and we have a very sparse fossil record, the population history usually is largely unknown. And so to infer, or sort of to make things easier, what I'm going to do instead of sort of trying to phase chromosomes and then work on that, which is what most methods do, I'm just going to assume that I just want to sort of try to infer sort of the compositional type. So I don't care whether this yellow bit is on this top chromosome or on this bottom chromosome, I'm just going to merge them together into one bit. So very briefly, what is the model I'm going to do? It's a hidden Markov model that there's some things oddly missing here. I hope that's, but it should be like a bar here. So this is local ancestry here. Then we have one level of genotype, and then one where we look at the sequencing read, so genotype likelihood model. Very briefly, what we do for the local ancestry is we subdivide the genome into discrete bins, and each of them we assign two ancestry. It can either be Neanderthal homozygous, Denisovan homozygous, or heterozygous between the two ancestries. And again, importantly, we don't distinguish this bit here where one is Neanderthal and the other is Denisovan with this state here where sort of the ancestries are reversed, and we just care about the heterozygous state. And then to get to the genotype, what we do is actually given this ancestry, we calculate what's the probability of the genotypes that we might see at any particular locus. And so there's a few sources of uncertainty you have to take into account here. So what we assume is that the sources are known populations, which are sort of the known high coverage Neanderthal or Denisovan genomes. And but the so the and then what we need to think about is, like, given the sample we have, what's the allele frequency here, then we have this sort of time period here where we know that the frequency observed here at this point, time point here is likely different from the one when gene flow happened. And then the third thing that we have to take into account is if you have our target individuals or the one we want to look at, the lineages, two lineages we have here might either have coalesced till they're up here or they may not have coalesced, which are the three things. And then what I'm doing here is to use a Paulding-Nichols model that Garrett, I think, introduced yesterday because it makes things simple. And we can sort of get likelihoods that are closed form and nice to work with. And we have one parameter F here that determines sort of the uncertainty that arises on this side of the tree here, and one parameter tau here that arises on this side here. And so this is what happens if you're homozygous for an ancestry. So if you're, say, only Neanderthal or only Denisovan, then we have to do this. If you're actually heterozygous, then it becomes a lot easier because we don't have any information about changes in allele frequency here. Our best guess for allele frequency here is simply what we observe down here. And likewise, because we only have one ancestry from, say, Neanderthal, in this case, we don't have to worry about coalescence here. And you just get sort of the probability of one or two alleles given the 50% allele frequency. And then the last thing that's an important part of the model is the genotype likelihood, where, again, for this particular model, the sort of primary issue is contamination. And what we know, or what I use here to sort of make this model more powerful, is that I sort of split reads by the length of fragments and the libraries that's been used. For example, there's certain treatments you can do with, say, hot phosphate or bleach that will primarily destroy contaminant DNA. Or we also look at if there's damage present or not, like these deaminations that one often sees in ancient DNA libraries. And because we know that fragments that have these deaminations will have different contamination profiles than fragments that do not. So to sort of start with data and sort of to show that the method works, I'm going to mainly focus on three sources. That the Africans is sort of a proxy I use for humans because they have the smallest amount of Neanderthal ancestry that we know in people. And so I'm mainly going to use them as a source of contamination. And then I use the three high-coverage Neanderthals and high-coverage Denisovan genome as sources, and restrict analysis only to sites that are known to be variable between these populations. So as a starting point, I'm just going to start with a modern human, with this Eustachym specimen. So this is a modern human dated to roughly 45,000 years ago that's been published, sequenced to about 40x coverage. And because it's an old genome, we see a lot of sort of these long bits of Neanderthal ancestry here. And again, so for some reason, gray here is not showing up, but I think it works as well. Like white here is just modern human ancestry, and everything that's bluish is heterozygous for modern humans and Neanderthal, and everything that orange is Denisovan ancestry, and you can see there's essentially very little Denisovan ancestry, but quite long tracks on all the chromosomes of Neanderthal ancestry. And so one thing we can do is, first we can just compare this to models that people previously published, because it's a high coverage genome, we can sort of use standard tools, and here I used the one that people use in the original publication, where they just looked for sort of matching homozygous sites, and then a model by Lawrence-Goff, where they have a hidden Markov model to detect Neanderthal ancestry. And you can see that my calls fit pretty well with both of those models, but except the foo model has a lot more sort of properly false positives or things that might be incomplete linear sorting. Then the other thing that I wanted to do, because I really wanted to sort of target the sort of low coverage Neanderthals, right, is to sort of just downsample this high coverage genome. So I just, instead of using all the, yeah, I'm showing just chromosome 2 here, by the way. So instead of using all the data, I just used only 1% of the data. So I just tossed out 99% of the reads randomly. And to my great relief is that the model still works quite well and is able to find at least a long Neanderthal track, right? So most of those here are like several million base pairs long. So they're intuitively, I think it makes sense that you don't need all that much data to detect them. It's only if you go down to, say, 0.1x or even 0.01x coverage where you start to lose power. But in general, this method works quite well, even if the data is crappy. You can also add more contamination. So it's just artificially adding in a modern human genome between 5% and 80% frequency. And we can see that doesn't really change much. We can, instead of using Africans from SGDP, we can use Africans from thousand genomes or other populations that have a putative contamination source. And again, we find it doesn't have a big impact, which is mainly because humans are quite different genetically from Neanderthals overall. And so this sort of this brief sketch of the validation, I want to come to sort of what I was looking at. So I want to look mainly at, yeah, first at early and late Denisovans, and then at Neanderthals and their ancestry, right? So this is a rough timeline of Siberian Neanderthals and Denisovans, Denisovans in orange. And so the first one I'm going to look at is Denisova 2 here, which is dated to, or has a quite a wide date range, but it's dated to roughly 160,000 years ago. And the data for that, which is published by Sloan et al., is quite poor. So here I have the coverage of sequence we have, and everything in blue is what I infer to be endogenous, so coming from this actual individual, and everything in red is what I think is contaminant, so coming from someone that handled this fossil or from some other source. And so particularly for reads that do not have this deamination in the beginning, we have, I think, more than 90% of the data being contaminant. But even though I think what I would like to appreciate is that about half the useful data comes from this fraction. It's really quite, I think, useful to actually include this data in the analysis. And then if you look at the decoding, you get something like this, right? So here in orange, you have Denisovan ancestry. In red, we have heterozygous ancestry. In blue, we have homozygous Neanderthal ancestry. And we do actually find quite long fragments. So this one here is, I think, about 25 centimorgue long, so about, I think, 20 million base pairs or something like that. So it's a quite long fragment on chromosome 11 that seems to be heterozygous for Neanderthal ancestry. And so given that this data is so crappy, I wanted to do some validation. And so what I came up with is an analysis like this. So I only look at all the SNPs where the Africans or the modern humans have like one fixed alleles, and then the Denisovans and Neanderthals have a distinct allele fix, right? So for example, this site here, African Neanderthals have the same allele, and Denisovans have a distinct allele with this orange bar here. And then I compared for these sites, what is the sort of genotype or what are the reads that we observe in Denisova 2, our sort of target individual. And what we see here in the sort of this region here, we see that it's pretty much 50-50, right? Between all those sites, we don't have a significant enrichment for the Neanderthal and Denisovans, which is exactly what we would expect for a heterozygous region. Whereas if you look at the flanking regions that are now displayed in this very ugly yellow in this projector here, we see that it only matches Denisovans, which is, again, what you would expect for a region that, or for an individual that's primarily a Denisovan. Right. Then we do the same thing for Denisova 8, which is dated to about 40,000 years later. And again, we see a very similar pattern that we have very long fragments on all the chromosomes, not all, but most of them, of Neanderthal ancestry. And again, I wanted to do some validation. I looked here on the X chromosome, which is easiest to look at because it's a male, so it's actually a haploid. And what we find here is that this individual in the flanking regions here in yellow looks like a Denisovan, but in sort of the inferred region at all but one site, it looks like the Neanderthals that we have. So again, I think this is something that's very hard to explain if you do not have gene flow. Then when we look at the later Denisova, so this is Denisova 3, which is the sort of high coverage genome, this is much younger, about 60,000 years old. We don't see much Neanderthal ancestry. We see a little bit here on the MH or in the HLA region on chromosome 6, but I think most people know that there the variation is quite, or this is a highly variable region, and we don't really know much about the HLA variation in Neanderthals and Denisovans, so I would take this as a grain of salt. But there might be low bis no amount of Neanderthal ancestry in this later Denisovan. And so I've sort of this pattern, right, that the early Denisovans that we have long and very recent Neanderthal ancestry, right? So long fragments mean that the ancestry is recent. And the fragments are in different positions of the genome, so it's likely not the same event, but very the most likely explanation is that it's a distinct event. Whereas in the late Denisovans, we have lower amounts of Neanderthal ancestry. If you then contrast that now with the Neanderthal, so here I'm going to first look at the Altai Neanderthal, which was the first high-coverage Neanderthal genome. When we look at its ancestry, then we find that she had also quite a bit of Denisovan ancestry with this red bit here, right? So now it's mostly blue because, yeah, the model infers that this looks like a Neanderthal, but it does find a bunch of fragments here where it looks like heterozygous for Denisovan. But if you look a later Neanderthal from about 70,000 years ago, from very close by, from Chagirska Cave, which is, I think, roughly 60 kilometers away from Denisova Cave. So they're geographically extremely close, but in time very far apart. We see very little Denisovan ancestry. And if you look at European Neanderthals from much later, so these are all roughly 40,000 years ago, we essentially see no Denisovan ancestry anymore. And sort of we have this, sort of in summary, in the Neanderthals, we find Denisovan ancestry again early on, but later on it disappeared, right? So this quite puzzling, or in some sense counterintuitive, observation is that, you know, I would expect if you have gene flow that populations become more and more similar. But here we actually see the opposite, that we have gene flow, but the interactions seem to be not persistent, right? And so one model that I think could explain this is where you have this sort of sink population in Siberia, you know, that Neanderthals are mostly maybe in Western Europe or Western Eurasia, not Western Europe, just Western Eurasia, and Denisovans might be somewhere in East Asia, and occasionally they make it to Siberia, but Siberia is maybe not the nicest place to live, right? And so the population density is very low, or they just, maybe they also just like it so much that they never move back, but in any way, like this sink population or this hybrid zone where they interact, but this actually doesn't have lasting consequences for their genetics. And later on, we don't see the signals of this mixtures anymore. And yeah, so with that, I would like to end with just some other sort of applications and a small ad. So we've also been using this method on modern humans to look for Neanderthal ancestry. And so this is a paper here by Mateja Hajdinjak, which looked at the Batrachiro individuals from Bulgaria, where she also used this method to show that they have quite recent Neanderthal ancestry. And so recently the ERC decided to keep funding this work for the next 5 years to primarily look at modern human or Neanderthal and Denisovan ancestry in modern humans. So if you are interested in this kind of work and look for a PhD position or postdoc, please talk to me. And last is this, I would like to end. Again, this is all based on a lot of work, particularly generation of data by pretty much everybody that has been in Leipzig for the last 10 or so years, and all the members of my group. And yeah, thanks a lot.